Hello, this is UCL Uncovering Politics, and this week we're looking at social trust. What is it? Why does it matter? And how can it be increased? Hello, my name is Alan Rennick, and welcome to UCL Uncovering Politics, the podcast of the School of Public Policy and Department of Political Science at University College London. We talk a lot about trust, or more often, the lack of trust in politics. Often we're referring to people's trust in politicians, but social trust, our trust in the people around us, matters too. The evidence from most countries is that social trust has been falling in recent decades, but the countries of Scandinavia have bucked that trend. Indeed, in Denmark, the survey evidence suggests that social trust has risen since 1979 by 30 percentage points. So what's going on? What factors shape social trust? What can policymakers do to promote social trust? And has COVID shifted any of the long-term trends? Well, I'm delighted to be joined to discuss these matters by Professor Peter Tistel-Dinesen. Peter is Professor of Political Science in the Departments of Political Science of both UCL and the University of Copenhagen, and he's been researching social trust in Denmark and around the world for over a decade. Peter, welcome to UCL Uncovering Politics, and let's start, as so often we do, with a definition. What is social trust?
Thank you very much, Alan, for the opportunity to speak about my work. I mean, that's it's an obvious place to start. Like, what is social trust? What do we mean when we speak about social trust? Why does it matter in the first place? So it's like, fundamentally, it's, as you also indicated in your intro, it's about trusting other people. And there are different forms of social trust. So this might be trust in family or in colleagues or member of social and ethnic groups, et cetera. And these are narrow or more particular forms of social trust. They are important in their own right, and they also have consequences for our relationship with those people or members of those groups. But the form of trust that I'm most interested in is actually what is sometimes in the literature referred to as generalized social trust. So that's basically trust in people we don't know, that we don't have any information about. So we can think about that as trust in strangers, essentially. And it's this type of trust that is tremendously important in modern mass-scale societies that we live in, because it has implications for how we interact with people we don't know, for anonymous others that we have countless interactions with on a daily basis in a society like that.
Just before we get into why social trust matters, just to explore a little bit further what it is. So I'm just thinking, you know, sometimes we talk about how I might think that it would be okay for me to drive very, very fast through a town because I trust that other people have sufficient sense of self-preservation to get out of my way. But that's not what we mean by trust here. So we're thinking that we trust particularly that people will kind of do the right thing, do the decent thing. We'll act fairly, that kind of thing.
Very much. I mean, you can think of it as a cooperative belief, basically. And that basically explains why trust is important for our cooperation with others in many, many different situations. So it's basically this idea that, you know, it's premised on the notion that humans are what is called conditional cooperators. So we would like to cooperate if we think that others do the same. We don't want to be the only ones doing it. Then it doesn't make any sense. And from that, it follows if we trust others to do the right thing, like you said, then we're also more likely to do so ourselves. So we're more likely to follow the rules, various prescriptions, and basically act in a more sort of decent way in various regards. And that eases our cooperation, our interactions with other people, and tend to make them more productive than if we had less trust and we were not able to form those relationships in a cooperative way, if that makes sense.
And I guess we're particularly concerned about this in politics because politics is itself a cooperative activity and we need to be engaging with each other in order for politics to work.
Exactly. And it also has implications for sort of the implementation side of politics, right? I mean, governments, states can spend a lot of money trying to enforce policies, but to make people act in certain ways. But of course, if they are sort of cooperative by themselves, you know, that makes things much easier and it frees up resources that can be spent in other ways. I think actually COVID is a good example of that. And we can also come back to that later, right? When people cooperate, when they wear masks, when they distance physically and so on and so forth, that basically help a country or society to shoulder the pandemic.
That's interesting, actually. So yeah, so if you were simply relying on people following the rules because there are punishments if they don't follow the rules, which I guess is the kind of scenario that we find ourselves in if there is no trust and people don't feel able to
cooperate. You need to have a very heavy-handed state in this case, right? Yeah. That need to monitor and sanction people who don't cooperate, right? And of course, that, you know, that becomes, again, much easier, much more smooth if you do have people who are cooperatively inclined. And trust is one very important element in that regard. And, you know, it makes it, you know, so it basically helps promote good government. And of course, it also has economic consequences because it eases many interactions because we don't need the third party to the same extent to basically oversee those interactions and secure that they are sort of being conducted in a good way. So again, it makes it cheaper to interact, and therefore it also helps promote economic growth, for example.
Hmm. Okay, so trust definitely matters and matters to us in politics.
If I may add.
Yeah, go for it.
It's also important in our private lives, right? It's hard to form a friendship without any form of trust, right? So it has huge benefits for us in order to form cooperative relationships with other people, right? So it's not only on a societal level. I think at the individual level, you know, for us personally, it also matters a lot.
And you're saying that applies to what you've described as generalized social trust as well as to more kind of direct forms of trust between individuals?
Right. I mean, the idea is that, you know, this generalized social trust spills over or like, you know, feeds into our interactions with concrete individuals, depending on how much information is available in that, to put it a bit more technically. Yes. But it tends to sort of color the interactions we have or shape the interactions we have with others.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. No, they're good. That makes sense. Great. Thank you. So what patterns of social trust do we find if we look in the world, if we look across countries over time, what do we find?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually one of the things that sort of stimulated my own interest in this topic, because we do find tremendous, very marked differences across countries. It's very rare that we see such differences, such variation, and, you know, both specifically or particularly between countries, but also over time. And most famously in the United States, we've seen a drop from a quite high level of trust in around 1960, where around 60% or so trusted other people in general. And that has gone down to around 30-35%. And Robert Putnam, famous political scientist from the United States, described this and try to explain why we see this pattern. And that has sort of been seen as an indication of, you know, civil society disintegrating. Basically, people don't, you know, relate to each other so positively anymore. And with the consequences, you know, we were talking about earlier, like the fear of, you know, basically the negative consequences this would have for government and society more broadly. Then on the other end, my home country, as you were mentioning in your introduction, we basically saw the exact opposite pattern. So we only have basically surveys or data back to 1979, but at that time, 47% of Danes indicated that most people can be trusted, which is a relatively high number already at that time. But basically since then, trust has only gone up. And at this time, and since around 2010 or so, it's been, you know, between 75 and 80% indicating that most people can be trusted, which is a very, very high, basically the highest or essentially the highest number in the world, you know, indicating that it's a very trustful society. And you see the same patterns, not to the same extent, but the same patterns in the other Scandinavian countries. And then you have Britain, you have United Kingdom, and you've seen a trend that is a little bit parallel to the United States, but not to the same extent. So there are some indications that, or that there are data basically showing that it was quite high around 1960, where it was just shy of, I think, 60% trusting others, so basically like the United States. But since then, it has gone down to around 30% at some point. But actually, in recent years, we've seen, or the recent decade or so, we've seen an increase. So now it's something around 40 to 45% trusting others, which is actually on a global or European scale a fairly high number. So it's maybe a bit lower than the Netherlands or a bit higher than Germany or something like that. So it's basically like a Northern European quite high trust society in that regard. On the other hand, you see other societies such as France, for example, very low levels of trust, often around 20, 25%, 30 maybe at highest. You see some Eastern European countries with also quite marked variation, but they also tend to have quite low levels of trust. And then But on a global scale, a country like Brazil, for example, has very high, very low levels of trust. Same for the Philippines. So you do see these marked, and in some of those countries, you see trust levels of around 10%, perhaps. So, you know, there's a very significant difference between that and then numbers in the high 70s that we see in Scandinavia, for example.
And yeah, so you're seeing huge differences there. Can we be confident that these differences are real, I guess? So you said that you're relying there on survey evidence. So basically you're asking people whether it's generally possible to trust others or not. I'm just thinking, you know, if we compare France and Denmark, for example, very similar cultures and societies in many, many ways. It's not as though people behave towards each other so differently, is it? I mean, are we capturing a real difference in people's kind of, in how people actually interact with other people in these surveys, or are the surveys potentially getting at something else?
That's a great question, the one you're asking, but also to some extent the question we're using for measuring trust. No, it's I mean, this is actually a big debate in the literature, in the academic literature, and very relevant. I mean, of course, it's fundamental to the knowledge that we think we have. Do we actually have indication that this is the case, that we are picking up variations in trust? So the typical question that's being asked is the following. Generally speaking, do you think most people can be trusted, or that you cannot be too careful in dealing with others? So again, this is intended to measure trust in unknown others, people we have limited information about, strangers, essentially. I think it's a reasonable but not a perfect approximation. And one of the criticisms, which I think is a fair one, is that, you know, what do people actually think about when they respond to this question? I mean, to some extent, this is inherent to all survey research, right? So every, you know, questionnaire has an element of that, but this is a fairly broad question. So there's a lot of room for interpretation, basically. And, you know, there's some research indicating that most people think about, you know, the generalized other or abstract others, so people they don't know. But there's also some people thinking about, at least they report that, neighbors or, you know, friends or something like that. And then, you know, you end up measuring something different, basically. I have an experiment. It's not published yet, so I still have to work a bit on it, that basically shows that it's true that, you know, some people probably do think about something else. But at the same time, this question basically meaningfully taps variation across individuals. So it might be that, you know, maybe we're overestimating the trust level by, let's say, 0.5 or something like that. But if that's the same across all individuals and across all societies, then it's still good for comparison, basically. But it's just in terms of the absolute level where we might be a bit off. So, you know, on balance, I would say, again, I agree. I mean, this is also should also be seen in the context of this question being formulated in the late 40s, basically. It's extremely rare that we can ask that something was asked 75 years ago and is actually still, to my mind at least, fairly valid to this day. So you know, and of course, having a long time series enable us to make these comparisons that we were just talking about across countries and so on, and within countries. So yeah, so I would say on balance, yes, it is not perfect, but it does measure something like trust or close to trust at least. And if I could just mention one last thing, there are also these studies showing that, you know, does this actually predict how people behave? You know, that was also what you're getting at. Again, this is a really essential question. And here there was some evidence about 20 years back showing that this actually measured trustworthiness, you know, that you yourself are trustworthy, not that other people are actually that you trust other people. But then subsequent research has increasingly indicated that it does measure trust, at least to some reasonable extent. So I guess this is a long answer basically saying, yes, I do think it does, but at the same time admitting that it's not a perfect question.
I'm just thinking that we need someone to do some experiments in the streets where they, in various different countries, where they kind of, some actor does something and we see, right. and people need to respond in a way that requires trust, and we see whether they do so. Are there experiments like that?
There are actually these sort of famous, I think it was Reader's Digest or something like that, that did it where they drop suitcases in the main train stations in countries around the world. And you know, interestingly, so the number of the share of return suitcases correlated highly with trust, for example. Okay. You know, I don't know how much I want to put into that. It's not like an academic study, but, you know, I do think, and actually for me, perhaps more, you know, I think this finding has a lot of resonance, you know, the variations across countries. So I remember talking to Brazilians living in Denmark, and You know, they're basically all indicating how shocked they were coming to Denmark. You know, the fellow people were incredibly naive. You know, they why do they trust so much? And they said, well, gradually over time, they also tend to adopt this perception of other people a bit more, or this belief a bit more. But you know, this was definitely very, very different from where they come from. So I do think that there are these variations that you tend to. I mean, I think that at least that has some like face validity to me. But you know, when I hear people explaining this.
Mm. I have to visit Denmark, experience this. We know that trust matters. We know that it varies a lot from country to country and indeed over time. So we definitely want to understand what factors are shaping this variation. What's the research on that? What do we know about the factors that influence social trust?
We know quite a bit, but there's still a lot we don't know. I think one fundamental question is whether is trust essentially a personality trait? You know, is it something that maybe that are shaped by genetics, maybe your early life socialization, the rearing, you know, environment that you grew up in, and so on and so forth? There's a lot speaking in favor of that. I sort of represent another perspective, which is saying that trust is partly, not exclusively, but partly also shaped by the experiences we have. You know, so for example, if we continuously experience discrimination, then we are probably likely to adjust our trust levels downwards. If we, in our interactions with others and with the state and representatives of the state, generally meet people who are fair to us and so on, then we tend to adjust it upwards. And actually, immigrants are an interesting case of this, right? And I've done some research on this, showing that immigrants migrating from a low trust setting like Brazil, as we talked about, to Denmark or the UK for that matter, then they do actually tend to become more trusting after having migrated. And you know, to me, that indicates there's something about being in an environment that is conducive to trust that shapes trust. And that shows again that you know those experiences are actually important in also pushing trust up or down. So we do know something about that. And I think like the experiential perspective is also interesting in the sense that it means that there are potentially things we can do to increase trust. I'm not saying this is easy, but the other perspective is it just makes it very hard to basically do anything. We just have to accept it. And I still think it's a little hard for that to explain. You know, you could argue that there are just different trust cultures, but this massive variation, I think, also is also linked to other things. And one important, the most important factor in my research is basically state institutions. So the institutions that we live under that structure the interactions we have with other people, if they are reasonably efficient and fair and impartial, they tend to, you know, first of all, they tend to make it less costly to trust others because, you know, people are sort of discouraged from acting in a non-cooperative or not trustworthy way. But on top of that, you know, it also sends the signal that most people are decent and, you know, that you know, people are basically trustworthy if they are again acting in an impartial and sort of fair manner towards you. So those put a bit more simply, like if you live in an uncorrupt society, you have much more trust. You have much more reason to trust other people. Conversely, if there's high levels of corruption, like who can you trust, right? You cannot trust authorities. You cannot trust your fellow person, right? Because that person can essentially use the institutions against you, or can bribe her his way into having a better treatment than yourself, for example. So that's, I think that is a very, very fundamental, it's quite well established that sometimes this is called quality of government, quality of the state, and that is essential and for me the main factor. And there's sort of an individual level manifestation of that is whether we trust institutions or not, or sometimes when we trust the politicians who are ultimately creating those institutions. And we do see a very tight relationship. So for example, if we trust the state, if we trust the police, if we trust politicians, then we also tend to be more trusting of other people. And then the question is, of course, you know, chicken and egg, like, oh, can we even differentiate those two things? Are they basically measuring the same thing? Is it just sort of a personality trait of trust making you more likely to trust everything, essentially? And together with my co-author, Kim Sønderskov, I've done some research on this. And basically what we find is that it tends to be trust in state institutions or trust in politicians that are actually driving social trust. So to me, that suggests that there is actually room for government actors of the state to, you know, increase trust by first increasing trust in themselves in different ways, for example, by acting in an impartial manner, like I spoke about before, or you know, basically in transparent decision making and so on and so forth, minimize corruption. So that I would say is a very important sort of factor in shaping trust and increasing trust, or eroding it for that matter. If I might continue, I could also say like there's been a big debate about immigration. Is immigration basically a challenge to trust? I've done a lot of research on this myself. Again, a lot with my co-author Kim Sønderskov. So this is a complicated, great question, and it's also obviously very sensitive. You know, it's basically the question of, well, you know, does it have negative implications for civil society when, you know, countries are diversifying due to immigration? And I mean, there's not like a simple answer to that. And I spoke about this before, but, you know, one aspect is what happens to those migrating to a high trust country, for example. And there, my research basically indicates that to a very significant extent, people do catch up. They do actually reach the level of trust of comparable people in the countries that they migrate to. So that sort of indicates that there are processes going on, basically helping elevate trust to a high level, or to a higher level. So that, you know, that sort of compositional aspect does not seem to be a big threat. The other aspect Danes
Just before you, do Danes who move to the UK become less trusting?
I was very low trusting even before. No, I think this happens much more sort of subconsciously, right? These are like small inputs you get on a daily basis. Let's do a podcast in a year, and I'll tell you what happened.
Well, yeah, I'll see if you accept the invitation.
that's a good point. There you have your behavioral indicator, right? So the other question, which has received more interest, is like, what happens to the native born's trust? Do they become less trusting when meeting immigrants, basically, where they live or work or and so on and so forth? And I think the conclusion, especially regarding neighborhoods or where people live, is that there is a moderate to weak negative effect. So, of course, there's also issues regarding causality and so on. But the best evidence we have basically indicate that, you know, natives living with more immigrants tend to have slightly lower levels of trust than those living in areas with fewer. So, you know, and that also holds up in a meta-analysis across a number of studies. But it, again, it's a quite moderate or not a super strong effect. And clearly there are other things sort of much more important for trust. So it's a little bit half empty or half full, right? You know, and Denmark is a great illustration of that. You know, we do find these effects on very good data in Denmark. We do see that trust tends to be lower in more diverse neighborhoods and so on. But at the same time, as we were talking about in the beginning, trust has increased massively in Denmark, right? In a period where immigration has only gone up, right? And the country is now much more diverse than it was in 1980. So clearly there are other forces basically driving up trust. So, and that's not to neglect the sort of the negative effect. It's just to say that it's important that we see that sort of against the other developments. And I think those two should always be seen in conjunction with each other, because otherwise it'll be simplistic or one-eyed.
Presumably more diverse neighborhoods tend to be more urbanized neighborhoods. They're often poorer neighborhoods. So you're presumably controlling for various other factors.
Right.
Making that analysis.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's interesting because in the UK, at least, I think that there's often the idea that relations among people are often best in multi-ethnic areas. So acceptance of diverse society is greater in more diverse areas, whereas opposition to diverse society tends to be associated actually with areas that are quite mono-ethnic.
Right. And I think that's, I think there's a number of aspects to this. One is that, you know, the people who choose to live in certain areas also have certain characteristics. They probably tend to be more pro-immigration, not necessarily, but probably on average. Otherwise, they could have chosen to live in a different area, for example. So that's one aspect. The other is sort of the so-called contact hypothesis that I think you're maybe also alluding to, which is the idea that, you know, when you meet out groups, then you tend to learn that they're like yourself. And, you know, that basically gives you a more realistic and ultimately more positive impression of them. You know, and that could also, for example, further trust and so on. And I mean, there is quite a bit of evidence for contact in other settings, not regarding trust, actually. That's also not what the theory is about to begin with. But that can happen. I think the problem is, how do you sort of create this contact, right? Or to put it in a simpler way, like how do you it's not easy just to make people become friends out of the blue, right? So you have to sort of find the conditions under which this sort of more superficial exposure that I've been studying can turn into this actual contact. Mm-hmm. One way of trying to test this is looking at the neighborhood, that the workplace, and I also have a paper doing that. And, you know, under the assumption that when people are colleagues, they're more likely to meet on, you know, a regular basis. Instead of just watching people outside your window, you actually do meet them. And, you know, maybe there's an initial sort of animosity, but that turns more positive over time and people become friendlier and so on. Mm-hmm. We don't actually find support for that in Denmark. But I mean, on the other hand, then we also we actually do see the negative relationship in workplaces. On the other hand, in schools, we don't see it. We don't observe that. So you know, there's a little bit of, I would say, contrary, but yeah, basically evidence pointing in different directions in that regard.
Very interesting. Let's have a very quick word on COVID. So I mean, none of the factors that you've mentioned so far as shaping social trust would obviously have been affected by COVID, I don't think. But then on the other hand, I'm kind of thinking that, you know, we've had a lot of talk over the last couple of years around people becoming more active in their local neighborhoods and having greater connection with people. But also, I suppose, a feeling of social isolation for many people and being cut off. So there are all sorts of factors that could be at play in the COVID crisis.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I think this is, I think there was this, or I don't know if it was articulated, but I think it's reasonable to ask, you know, is this actually a chance to rebuild civil society, right? There was a little bit the same idea in the US after 9/11, you know, this is a terrible thing happening, but maybe this could be a platform for, you know, us getting back together in a sense. Mm. And COVID is maybe a bit peculiar in that sense, because it also made it harder for us to actually interact with other people, right? At least face-to-face, right? So it was more virtual for a period at least. But I think that is true, you know, and I think if you see your compatriots or, like, you know, people around you basically observing the rules, and you feel, you have this feeling of, we're doing this together, you know, we're trying to face this challenge, then I think it can have these positive consequences. There's evidence from Sweden showing that there might be like a slight positive effect, but mostly no effect, which I think is also reasonable to expect, given that trust does not change, like it does not tend to change sort of, at least not in the aggregate, like very, very dramatically from one time to another. One thing that did happen and that was very responsive to the handling of the COVID situation was political trust or trust in state institutions, right? And as I said before, that tends to rub off on social trust. So I think through that trust, we could basically expect sort of a downstream effect on social trust. And that trust in the state and politicians have really gone up and down, right? It actually increased quite a lot to begin with. This is sort of a so-called rallying around the flag idea that, you know, we support our government in a time of crisis in order for them to sort of lead us through. And then, like, over time, of course, things become more contentious and so on and so forth. That could have like a knock-on effect on social trust.
Mm. So I guess the final question if policymakers want to increase social trust, what should they do? And so I think there's one clear implication from what you've said so far, that they should not be corrupt. They should act in a way that is perceived as fair. Right. Current British government probably has some things to learn on this front. What other lessons should we be drawing out from this?
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, it's you know, so I hope I convinced you that trust is important. But then, you know, okay, then the next question is, how do we create trust? And it's not so simple necessarily, right? Mm. And exactly like you said, yeah, combat corruption is important. I think creating institutions that are transparent and fair, I think also to some extent by setting good examples to the point you just made, right? You know, if there's just different rules applying to you, whether they are regarding, you know, having parties or, you know, getting contracts or whatnot, I mean, that those, I think, indicate that there's sort of a big divide also, and, you know, that other people are not necessarily of the moral habits that we would like them to be. So I think that is one, I think, important way to try to do that. And of course, in terms of transparency in government, including in the bureaucracy, having fair and efficient courts and police and so on and so forth. I think it's also, I think the media also deserves an important role in this regard, or has an important role, because they are the ones exposing corruption or, you know, embezzlement or like the type of like untrustworthy behavior, right? So the more that they can basically expose that, I think that the better, like they enable the citizens to basically keep governments or politicians in check, if that makes sense.
Of course, there can be a problem if if what they expose is a lot of corruption. I mean, if transparency leads people to realize that the system is more corrupt than they thought, then.
But my point would be that then, you know, if they know about it, then they have, I mean, of course, this is more complicated and there's, you know, all sorts of sort of conditioning factors also. But, you know, exposing this is also is a way for making people realize this happens and then they can vote accordingly or organize. Or it's also a way of discouraging politicians from being, from acting in this way. I think my own country, Denmark, is actually a really good example of this. There's an extremely low tolerance for anything that could be construed as remotely corrupt or something like that, right? So we've had scandals in Denmark that I think in most countries would never be considered a scandal. You know, some politician spending, you know, there was this case of someone flying on first class, even though, you know, he was actually allowed to do so. You know, people found it like this is a waste of public money. And you know, so it's also a way of keeping governments on their toes, if you know what I mean. Like, and the media is, of course, crucial in actually exposing this. And of course, they can be too much sometimes, but it is very important that, you know, that people are actually, you know about this. And of course, that the fact that you know as a politician that you are likely to be exposed if you do something that's not okay is also sort of a disciplining factor, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah, I guess it's just, I'm just trying to think about what the recipe is that will work in a variety of contexts. So if you imagine a country that is characterized at the moment by very low trust, and then you increase transparency and expose what's going on. But because trust is so low, there's very little faith that people will be able to do anything about that through collective action, through engaging in politics.
Right.
So, yes. You know, what's the route out for people who find themselves in that kind of situation?
I mean, that is in many ways like the billion-dollar question, right? I mean, then you would have the recipe for successful societies, right? I will definitely not go as far as claiming that. I do think trust is one aspect, but I think what you point to is also these sort of negative equilibria, right? Like, how do you get yourself out of this situation, right? And because it seems like all the factors that are sort of working together, it's hard to change one without the others in a sense, right? And then you have the positive equilibria in other places that, you know, enable good government, et cetera. So it is hard. I mean, again, like trying to invest in, you know, in training of you know, people manning the state, essentially, and, you know, in instilling various procedures that are sort of, you know, making it more efficient and also more fair. And ultimately, this should trickle down to people. And that will sort of change their perceptions of other people and also of the state and make them more positively inclined. But needless to say, this doesn't happen from one day to the next. And, you know, especially if there's like a long history of the opposite, right? But, you know, there are cases of countries that have actually improved corruption or like have lowered corruption, right? And there we would expect to see an increase in trust with the positive consequences following from that.
Mm. Well, this has been great, Peter. Thank you so much. Our time is up and I feel we've begun to scratch the surface, but there's so much more to explore here. So we'll have to have you back onto UCL Uncovering Politics again sometime in the future. But thank you so much. This has been excellent. And during our discussion, we have drawn on several of Peter's research articles on social trust. We'll put the details of those in the show notes for this episode. Next week, we're discussing British welfare policy and its transformation in recent decades. As ever, to make sure you don't miss out on that or other future episodes of UCL Uncovering Politics, all you need to do is subscribe. You can do so on Apple, Google Podcasts, or whatever podcast provider you use. I'm Alan Rennick. Our producer is Abby Turner. Our theme music is written and performed by John Mann. This has been UCL Uncovering Politics. Thank you for listening.